Okay, I want to get to some of the songs. Tell me about Prince Charming Tango.
Paul had the line, "I thought you'd be taller," for that. That it started with that line, which of course ended up becoming the title of our first album. And I basically took the line and the idea and ran with it, and I wrote a draft of the song, and then he did his editing magic on it, and we had a song that was one of our first numbers that we ever did.
At the Valencia?
At the Valencia.
At the Rose?
Yeah.
How about Outfield Blues?
Well, that was Outfield Blues. That was one of the songs that was completely autobiographical. I mean, I had a terrible time when I was in junior high school and high school, in gym class, not being athletic, and you know how they would just sort of throw you into sports if you were a boy and just assume that you knew how to play the games without ever explaining. You know, I remember running around in gym class and football games and stuff, no idea how the game worked. I would just kind of run around and fake it, and I'm sure a lot of us did that.
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
I had no clue.
Yeah. And, you know, of course we were too embarrassed to ask, you know.
I didn't care.
Well, yeah, or care, but, you know, if you did. So that's where that song came from. And I, of course, I knew it was something to experience that a lot of gay men share, and that was one of the first things I ever wrote about.
How about What Kind of Self-Respecting Faggot Am I?
Oh, I that song, a good friend of mine who was doing stand-up comedy at the Valencia Rose when we were performing there, I'm trying to remember, she had a punchline of one of her jokes was something like, "I can't fix my car and I don't play pool. What kind of self-respecting lesbian am I?" And I stole a line from her and just changed it about being a gay man and not fitting into all the sort, you know, into what was expected of me as a gay man. Because when I first moved to San Francisco, I didn't even really hang out in the Castro at all. I didn't go to bars. I didn't really like bars. I didn't get the whole clone look. You know, I didn't dress like that. And I was much more identified with, you know, with the 60s, and I was much more of a hippie than a San Francisco gay man, or than an urban faggot, you might say. So that's where that song came from. And the funny thing was that so many things in the song that, I mean, I didn't even know what to write about because I didn't know what I should know. And Paul gave me all the information I needed. So he was, that was one of our best collaborations, I think.
Was he more the Castro clone?
Well, I wouldn't say he was a clone, but he was, he was much more comfortable and sort of, well, he'd lived in New York City for a few years and he'd been out longer than me, and, he knew his way around the gay community a lot more than I did.
Okay, the song Lost Emotions is beautiful. Can you talk about that?
All of the situations in that song were true and were personal experiences of mine. One was about talking with my brother one time when we were crying in a restaurant and just like how frustrated I felt that I couldn't just touch his hand because of the situation we were in. One was about saying goodbye to a friend in a public place where I was afraid to hug him and show my emotion. And of course the last verse is about walking with your lover down the street and being afraid to hold hands or show affection. And it was just something that I thought would make a good song. I didn't know of any other songs that really covered that subject in the way that I wanted to.
The song Homophobia, I know we mentioned it a little bit, just kind of in general.
Mm-hmm. I think I had just heard the word homophobia for the first time. I mean, it was, you know, it hasn't always been around, and somebody finally coined it, and it was, people were using it a lot, and I thought there was something kind of musical about it, just like the sound of it, and that's where I came up with the homophobia, and that was the first song that Paul and I wrote together. Yeah, it was, the great thing about that song was that we were able to constantly write new verses for it, the way it's structured, it lended itself to that, so anytime something I knew happened in the community that was a good, you know, instance of discrimination or homophobia, we'd try to write a verse about it.
Okay, you very seldom recorded songs by other people, but a good exception is Must Have Been Drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Larry Havlek was a terrific songwriter from Minneapolis. I don't know whatever happened to him, but we heard that song and we decided to perform it because we needed an extra up song in our show or something, and people loved it, and we never intended to record it because we didn't want to record other people's material. But when we got together with Teresa Troll to talk about working with her, she had never seen us perform, and so we showed her a videotape of one of our performances and in which we had done that song, and she said, "Oh, you gotta record it, you gotta record it." And so she really convinced us to do it. And I think also because she knew musicians who were great bluegrass players, and she thought it would be really fun to make it a full-blown bluegrass number, which we did on that album.
So it's an excellent song. And
it's a great song. Yeah.
You really can't find another recording of it by anybody else.
No, no. So I'm glad we did, and, you know, gave Larry a little boost, and he deserved it.
On to Emotional Roller Coaster. Let's start with the title track.
Mm-hmm. Well, that pretty much speaks for itself. That, you know, our relationship was an emotional roller coaster. And it was just a funny idea for a song.
Straighten Up the House.
Straighten Up the House was inspired by, well, again, I was talking before about finding the humor in a situation that otherwise might be very sad or frustrating. We had, stayed with, a couple of men, so I don't remember where it was, and in their house, their mother, I think, was coming over to visit or something. Yeah, that's what it was. And they told us that, you know, they asked us to be, if we could be a little more discreet, and they were going around the house, you know, taking down pictures and trying to make the guest room look like it was actually, you know, another bedroom that was being used. And that's where I got the idea for the song. Again, I kind of made it into a funny song because I couldn't resist the pun of the line, straightening up the house.
I love the song, Give Me a Homosexual.
Do you really?
Yes.
Well, we used to talk a lot about internalized homophobia and how the whole idea of finding a boyfriend who was quote-unquote straight acting or straight looking was really internalized homophobia, and how, what does that really mean anyway? And it was just something, a subject that I thought was worthy of exploring in a song. And I think some people might have taken it as me saying that, you know, when I say I like a man who's glad to be gay or who's made it the style of his life, that what I was saying was that I like men who are feminine, but that's really not what it was about. It was about wanting to love somebody who loved themselves and who was completely comfortable with being gay.
The song, Living with AIDS.
I remember that we hadn't written anything about AIDS yet, and it was, you know, it was the issue that dominated the gay community for so many years, of course, and I hadn't written anything because I just didn't know what to say about it that would be useful. And then we had a very good friend who had AIDS and was really struggling with it, and he was a very strong-willed person, and every time you talked to him, you know, he was often very optimistic and would say, you know, I feel better today, and I, you know, I feel like I'm getting stronger or whatever. And then you talk to the people who were around him taking care of him, and they were really negative, and they'd always say, oh, you know, he doesn't know what he's saying, and, you know, of course he's going to die. And that's where that came from. I just thought, well, the one thing we can do for people with AIDS, we don't have a cure yet, but we can support them emotionally and give them hope. And that's as important as the right medicine, you know. The tragically ironic thing about that song was that we had this big concert coming up at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. It was the first time that we were playing there. It was kind of a big deal. It was a mainstream venue, and we managed to get the gig, and we managed to sell the place out. So it was a really big night for us. This was like July of 1986. We worked our butts off to try to get that song finished for that show. We really wanted to premiere it there, and we were able to. We performed it, and we were kind of shaky, but we got through it, and people loved it. And then the next morning, we found out that our friend John had, in fact, died probably sometime while we were on stage that night. And we just felt like that was not a coincidence, that somehow, you know, we had channeled some of his message to the world, perhaps through our song. So it was a very special song for us.
How about the sodomy song?
That was just, I wrote the sodomy song because I wanted to just point out the absurdity of the sodomy laws, and I thought that it was kind of a funny and ironic subject, if you, what do I want to say about that song?
Was there a problem with it being banned on the radio?
I don't know if that's ever been played on the radio. Oh, yeah, I do remember during the March on Washington, Oh, maybe that's what it was. I remember something about the being played during the March on Washington, or well, I think we performed it on stage at the 87 March. And, they had said that they weren't allowed to play it, so the announcer would just cut in and say a few words every time we got to the, you know, the four letter words in the song or whatever it was.
The song Hymn.
I wanted to write something about the Catholic Church for years, and musically I wanted to do something a cappella. So that was it. And that's the song that, if I were going to write it again today, I think I might write it a little differently. I'm not sure I would take the same tone, because it's a little strident. But I was mad. I really wanted to talk to them.
It was not too strident for me.
Good. Glad to hear that. Well, I mean, I don't need to be apologizing. As a songwriter, I think about what is the most effective way to get your message to somebody who doesn't necessarily share your views. And I don't think that song necessarily does that. It might make those of us who already have those views feel better. But that's the preaching to the choir. I mean, my brother is a born-again Catholic, more or less, and he certainly didn't think much of it. I mean, I don't know that I could write a song that would preach somebody like that, but, I might like to try again to find a different way. But, you know, it is what it is, and, it came out beautifully because we got Michael Callan to come in and sing on that one. And originally we were going to get a whole choir, but we ended up overdubbing Michael's voice, and he did it such a beautiful job. We just used him, and it, we're pretty pleased with how it came out musically.
Roughly how many people were in the Michael Callan choir?
Well, we hadn't gotten that far. You mean just how many of him did we?
Yes.
I think it's three or four. Yeah. We just overdubbed it. He did all the harmonies, and they were all done, like, you know, on the fly. It wasn't arranged beforehand. It was just made up as we went along in the studio. It was really an amazing day. We spent a whole entire day just doing that recording, and just kept getting better and better. And Michael was unbelievably tireless. You know, he worked so hard on that. And enjoyed it, I think.
You listen to it, and you can't believe that's one person.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. I definitely can't believe it's a man who can sing that high. He had an incredible voice. I mean, it just soars. It was very effective on that song.
Well, you had some good help on the song No False Hope, too.
Yeah, yeah. That song came out pretty well. We got Alex Dobkin and Holly Neer and Frank to come in and sing. That was great. They all happened to be in town at the same time. And, you know, of course, it was very flattering to have them singing on our record.
Talk about the song itself.
I think that the idea of that song was maybe just a kind of a further extension of what I tried to say in Living with AIDS. Well, there's no such thing as false hope. Just the idea that you can't take away what somebody believes, you know, and that anything is possible. I felt like at that time the media was still being very negative, and everybody was talking about dying from AIDS, but still nobody was talking about. People were just starting to talk about living with AIDS, emphasis on the living. And
yes, this was when 91 the album came out, but you probably wrote it earlier.
Yeah, I think I did, the song itself. And so I just wanted to try to stress that idea further and support people who are living with AIDS. And musically, I wanted to write something that sounded kind of like a pop song, so that's why it sounds like it does. I think I succeeded.
I want to touch again on One of the Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of talk about that.
Well, as I said, just to me by a friend who was a gay teacher, and when he said that he wished he could be more out for the students and for the gay students in his class, I knew what he meant, and I knew how important that and useful that would have been to me, to any of us, when we were kids in school. I think that when you're growing up and you don't have any role models, you don't see anybody being the kind of person that you think you might grow up to be, it's another way that we're kind of made invisible, and that we're not sort of told that, you know, that our feelings aren't valid.
And he felt like one of the enemy?
Yeah, he said that, you know, there were kids in his class where he was, you know, he was pretty sure that they were going to grow up to be gay. He could already, you know, had a sense, and or even not even just them, but for anybody, he wasn't able to say anything positive about gay rights if the subject came up, you know, which it can come up these days in a class and situation. And I felt like I had a lot of compassion. I have, did have, and do have a lot of compassion for gay teachers, because the issue of gay people being around children is such a charged issue. And, you know, it freaks people out, people who aren't on our side. And I certainly couldn't say, well, you just have to come out at all costs, you know, risk losing your job, because that isn't always the best way to handle the situation. So all I tried to do in that song was to tell his story, and with the hope that someday things would get better.
Okay, one from the solo album, Baby Take Advantage of Me.
Mm-hmm.
I love that one.
I don't know what to tell you about that song. It was just a fun idea for a song. Again, it was musically, it was a style that I wanted to experiment with, I wanted to play with.
Are there any songs on that solo album that were particularly meaningful or that you would want to comment on?
The song These Things is, I think it's one of the best songs that I've ever written. I really wrote it to try to come to terms with my feelings about romantic love. And I'm really pleased with how it came out. The other song on that album that I really like is called Battle Scars. And it's just, I guess I like it because it's really introspective and kind of dark and different from anything else that I've done. And I feel like it shows a different side of me. I like a lot of the songs on that album. I like When I Hear a Love Song a lot. I think I like all those songs because for the most part I think they work as well musically as they do lyrically, or even more, which wasn't always true of our other material.
How was that album received?
It didn't sell as well as I had hoped. I think that I was a little disappointed. But people who did buy it, I got a lot of compliments on it. A lot of people really liked it. My friend Suede, I don't know if you know Suede.
Yes, I do.
Actually recorded the song that John Bacchino and I wrote, A Measure of Sadness, which is on that album. So yeah. I got a little bit of radio airplay on that album, so that was good.
On to Let's Flaunt It. How about the title track?
Let's Flaunt It was written very early on. We just never got around to recording it for a long time. And I think when I wrote that lyric, I was just wanting to make fun of all the ways that non-gay people describe us sometimes, using words like avowed homosexual and admitted homosexual, and how, you know, how much power those words can be given. And then the fact that they're just words, and it doesn't, in another sense, they really don't mean anything. You know, it's somebody else's attitude.
Please tell me about Burning Angels.
Burning Angels? Well, as the liner notes say on the album, I was actually driving into LA during the riots, and I was very much aware of what was going on and thinking about it a lot. And I just thought that sort of the metaphor of the fires right next to the ocean, because Los Angeles is on the ocean, I just thought it was an interesting metaphor for justice. And
what was the song about?
Well, the song's about, well, it's about a lot of things. I mean, it was inspired by the LA riots, but it's really about how you can't. Actually, I probably need to look at the lyrics again.
Wasn't it about Dan White's verdict?
Yeah, it was about that. Because when Dan White's verdict came down, of course, there was a huge riot in San Francisco, you know, which involved police cars being burned and everything. And I think I was taking with the metaphor of the fire and the water in the ocean, because, you know, it takes water to put out a fire, and it was right there. And in the same way that it just takes love and justice to put out, to end discrimination. And it's such a simple thing. It only takes a shift in people's hearts and minds, and yet it seems to be so hard for us to do it as a society. And that's why I use the metaphor of the fire, and because the LA riots reminded me of what had happened in San Francisco when Dan White's verdict came down.
The song, If There's a God, He's a Queen.
I think that kind of speaks for itself. I fell in love with the landscapes of the Southwest, and that's why I wanted to move, one of the reasons I wanted to move to Santa Fe. And, I mean, it really just like the song says. Of course, gay men are known for having a great flair for visual design and everything. And when you see some of the beautiful places in this area and all over the whole earth, it was just a silly idea that I couldn't resist.
How about Some of My Best Friends Are Straight?
I don't really remember what made me write that song or where the idea came from. It probably came from somebody saying to me, you know, some of my best friends are gay. Somebody trying to prove to me that they were liberal.
Well, we just played on the radio last Saturday night, Homophobes in Robes. Mm-hmm. It's still timely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Tell us about that one.
Well, it's just so obvious. I mean, I thought it was so funny every time you see any see images of the KKK or the Pope. I must have seen some images back to back. It just hit on me, the irony of them wearing long robes, you know, could be called dresses, being so homophobic. And then when I came up with the title Homophobes in Robes, too good not to write. Yeah, yeah.
Which do you think has been your most controversial song?
Probably If There Is a God, He's a Queen. Yeah. And I was surprised by that because I think it was kind of a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, first of all, the song is really very lighthearted, and I think anybody who would really be offended by that because of their religious beliefs probably has very shallow religious beliefs. So I never took it very seriously, but it offended people. I think if you really read the lyrics, you can tell where we're coming from. I think that was the song that kept that gave us a hard time with Brave Boys, that made it hard for us to get it printed, because the printing companies that we were sending it to actually were in the South, in very conservative areas, and it probably had a lot to do with it, that song.
Is there a particular song that seemed to be the most popular when you did it live over the years?
Guilt Trip. People loved Guilt Trip. You know, we couldn't really do a show without it.
And why do you think that was so?
Oh, I think it's because it's a funny song, because so many people can relate to it, and everybody's gone through a breakup, and everybody has to admit to having those kinds of feelings sometimes. And it's just kind of a fun romp, kind of a fun fantasy. People really like that song. Don't Use Peanuts for a Brain was always a very popular song. Of course, that was our concert sing-along. All the Up songs were really popular. What Kind of Stuff Was Breaking Faggot Am I, Prince Charming Tango. If There Is a God, He's a Queen.
Okay. Pick three songs you're the most proud of.
Most proud of? I'm very proud of These Things, as I mentioned before, from my solo album. I think it's one of my best songs. And I also like Love Is All It Takes, which is a song about gay and lesbian parents from Be Political, Not Polite. And I was very flattered at somebody I was talking to, I think it was somebody who wanted to quote the song in a book about gay and lesbian parenting, asked me how, she said, so how old are your children? She just assumed that I had children to be able to write that song. So that made me feel like I had gotten inside the feelings of a gay, you know, a parent pretty well. Because of course I don't have children. That song and, what else? It's really hard to narrow it down. I guess I like Guilt Trip a lot, too. I think that's a pretty funny song.
The reason I ask the question that way is if I found that from experience, if I say, of what song are you the most proud, they say, oh, I can't pick between my children. Or
yeah, yeah. Well, I definitely like a lot of songs more than others, but I don't know if I can narrow it down to 3, maybe 10.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there an overall message to your music?
I can't say that there's one message that would, you know, be an umbrella for all of them, no. I mean, obviously many of our songs have a positive gay message, but in general, when I wrote songs, I'm talking in past tense now because I'm not writing these days, but I guess it would be true if I started writing again. I don't like to write a song unless I have something to say, first of all. I think for me, the point of writing a song was always to put some truth across or to find a new way of saying something that's already been said, or to solve some kind of problem. That's what I tried to do in almost every song I wrote, except maybe some of the funny ones, which were just, you know, for fun. I guess I believe that art should not only be beautiful or funny or interesting, but it should be useful, you know, and I always try to keep that in mind.
Tom Wilson Weinberg suggested this question to me, because I wrote him, what would you want to know? And he wrote back several. The one I picked from his list was, what's your outstanding performance memory?
We had so many great shows. I mean, we had so many great fans. Again, there isn't really one that stands out. But I was really excited about playing the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco, which I mentioned earlier. And it was a really hard gig to get. And we were the first openly gay male act that ever played there, that ever headlined there, at least. And I used to go to shows there when I first moved to San Francisco, and I saw many, many people that I admired on that stage. everyone from Holly Nair to Lily Tomlin to Loudon Wainwright, lots and lots of people. And I'll just never forget driving to the show the night of that we were playing there and finally seeing our name on the marquee. There was a part of me that didn't believe it was really going to be there until we turned the corner to see it. And the show itself probably wasn't our best performance ever, but it was one of the most exciting. It was really an exciting moment. It was a moment where I felt like we had arrived somewhere, and so that stands out.
What year was that?
That was July 1986. It was after Trouble in Paradise came out. Yeah.
For what do you think the act Romanowski and Phillips will be remembered?
I think, and I hope that we'll be remembered for being out and proud, and for telling many of the stories in our community that that haven't been told before in music.
Any career regrets?
Oh gosh, yeah, but who wants to talk about those?
Okay, we'll hear about the Volkswagen that broke down.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a lot of things I'd do differently. We made a lot of business decisions that were pretty dumb. But we weren't really, you know, we weren't business people, really. I mean, we did pretty well, but, you know, we didn't always make the best decisions because we tended to think more with our hearts than with our minds, I think. But that served us in a lot of ways, too. So I don't think about the regrets too much, you know.
How do you feel about being given the Out Music Heritage Award?
Extremely proud. Extremely proud. Yeah, it really is a wonderful thing to be recognized by your community. It's a wonderful thing.
Do you think there's a market for out-of-the-closet gay music today?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, one of the reasons our career ended is because we felt like the market was starting to disappear. And it's very hard to know. I mean, we felt like it seemed to us that there was a lot more gay material showing up in the mainstream, you know, with things like The Ellen Show and, you know, Will and Grace and...
But not on album.
No, but it seemed like the new generation wasn't as starved for gay images in music and art as they were when we started. We knew that we were able to take advantage of that. You know, we were filling a need that nobody else was. But it really felt like the young people today didn't need it so much. I don't know.
Well, I can think of artists like Mark Weigel, who does wonderful work in, I'm not sure how many people even have heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know who he is. Right, right. But, you know, the demand dropped off for our music to some degree, and concert attendance kind of dropped off in the early 90s, and so that was one of the reasons we stopped, because we weren't reaching the audience that we needed to. And we tried to reach a younger audience by playing doing a lot of college concerts in those years, many of which, in fact, weren't even, you know, sponsored by the gay groups on campus, but they would be brought in by the, you know, the general activities board or whatever. So we had a lot of non-gay people working on the events, but still didn't quite save our career. And but it's hard to say. I mean, you know, times change and they go back and forth, from pendulum swings from left to right, and certainly we're in another very conservative era politically. So who knows? Maybe there is still a need for it. I don't know.
Tell me about the new album.
Well, I am doing something very different now. I play the accordion, and I play mostly French music. And this all kind of happened gradually over the last 8 years. I started learning the accordion in 1995, just because it was something that I always had wanted to do, right around the time that our career was winding down. And I totally fell in love with the instrument. At first, I just wanted to learn it kind of because I thought it would be fun to do it in the act as kind of a joke, you know? Because in this country, the accordion is mostly associated with polka music, and we had a polka that I did on my solo album, and then we performed it sometimes. Well, anyway, I ended up falling in love with French music when I started hearing old recordings of music, you know, French music from the 40s, and I had always been interested in learning to speak French, and so I started taking classes and just kind of following my bliss, and it ended up that that's what I've been doing to make my living the last few years. I do a lot of private parties, and I play in galleries, and I play in restaurants occasionally.
Are you doing performing to support the album since its release?
Well, I decided to make this an album of this music that I'm doing now, really just to have something to sell at my gigs, and just because I hadn't done a recording for a while, I wanted to. It's very different because a lot of times I'm playing in the background. I'm not really. I've done a few concerts, but most of the time I'm doing background music, and this actually has been a wonderful thing for me because I was really tired after doing From Dusk Till Phillips for so many years, and to be able to make a living in music and not having to worry about ticket sales or write press releases or do the booking or any of that stuff has really been wonderful. It's a lot less stressful. So, yeah, I made that record last year just to make a recording of what I'm doing now.
Have you found people receptive for it, or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everybody, I mean, I've gotten a lot of nice compliments on it. People really like it. I haven't really tried to promote it nationally. That really wasn't my intention. It's very different from what I used to do before. So the career that I had before, it hasn't even really been helpful in terms of promoting this because it's just a whole other audience. So I haven't really tried to promote it too much within the gay community, certainly.
I think you did at least one show with Suede.
Oh, you heard about that?
I research.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, I happened to be in Provincetown last October when she was doing a concert there. Well, actually, I mean, I sort of planned a trip around it because I wanted to go to Boston to visit Paul anyway, which I did. She had invited me, you know, anytime I was around to do a song with her, so I said, let's do it, you know. So it was really fun.
What's the name of the CD and what does it mean?
CD is called Je m'appelle Dadou, and Dadou is my French nickname. It was given to me by some French people a few years ago when I went and spent a couple of months in the south of France. And I had taken my accordion and I played a lot for the people that I met there, and it was just wonderful because they were so delighted to meet an American that knew French music, and I was just delighted that they were opening their homes to me and letting me speak my bad French with them, and I had a great time. And they were asking me about my name one night, and I said, you know, I mean, because Ron doesn't sound very French, no matter how you say it, right? And then somebody said, oh, is it like the song Dadou Ron Ron? Because they all know that song. There's actually a French version of that song, which is pretty funny. And I said, yeah, that's it. And somebody else said, oh, that's great. We'll call you Dadou. And that became my French nickname. And in fact, a lot of my friends today know me as Dadou, not as Ron. So I just had to call the album Je m'appelle Dadou.
Is there any particular song on the album you'd like to talk about?
Well, about two-thirds of the album is instrumental pieces that I wrote for the accordion, which I'd never done before, record instrumental music, that is, or the accordion for that matter. So there's some really nice pieces that I'm very proud of that I think are very musical and kind of whimsical and fun to listen to. And then there are some old French songs by some well-known French composers like Charles Trenet and Serge Gainsbourg, if you know French music. And then there's one song that I actually wrote lyrics to in French myself. In English, the translation is Desert Rain. It's a love song. That's the first song I've ever written in French, so that was kind of special. It's an album that's light, it's fun, it's very musical, and it's also the first album that I ever produced myself completely. It's just me and the engineer in the studio. I mean, aside from the other musicians that I brought in, but it's mostly me.
Listening to it, I can sure imagine sitting in some French cafe, drinking wine, and it's raining.
That's the idea.
Okay, this might be kind of different. Given that it's kind of unusual to be interviewing you separately, maybe this gives me an opportunity to ask, is there any particular question or questions I should ask Paul?
Ask him what it would take to get him to perform again. Because he has a lot of talent, and he's not doing it at the moment, performing, that is. But he's extremely musical. He's really brilliant, and he didn't always get the credit that he deserved for it because my name appears on most of the songs as the writer, which I was. But I learned so much of what I know about music from working with him all those years. I mean, he really, and not necessarily willingly, because I used to get very upset when I wrote a song that and he didn't like it, you know, or thought it wasn't there yet, thought it wasn't finished yet. But I can't say enough good things about how much I respect and admire his talent and how great it was to work together all those years. We're a good team. The thing about us is that our talents and our strengths really dovetail. You know, there's not one thing that both of us are really good at, but together pretty much have it all covered. So I think that's why we were successful.
Is there any question I should have asked you?
No, you've done fine.
You're probably thinking, when is this going to be over?
Well, 2 hours now. That's a lot of stuff.
Almost. Just a couple wind-up questions. Are there any recorded R&P songs that have not been released?
Oh, well, nothing finished. We actually have an album about a third finished in a can that we started in 98 that we never finished because we ran out of money. And that's the only thing. But no, everything else, everything that's out there is everything that we have. And everything that we ever released, we ever recorded, we released. Yeah. I know, it's always amazing to me that artists who come up with these albums with, you know, their basement tapes or whatever.
Yeah.
They have all this stuff that's unreleased, and I always think, my God, it's so expensive, first of all, to record an album. Why would you not release it? But sometimes it happens for various reasons. It never happened to us.
The song Telephone Sex is in your song, but not on the album.
Wow. Yeah, we performed that. We performed that quite a few times. We never thought that ultimately it was such a great song that it would be, you know, that was worth recording. I mean, there were some songs that worked well live, but not necessarily on an album. That was one of them.
Are there any videos available?
No. We.
What a shame.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, money.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, it could still happen someday. It's just the post-production is so expensive. I have we made it like a 6-minute video demo that has some little performance clips, but it's not a full concert video.
You've been so patient with me.
Not at all. No, it's fun to talk about it, you know. I'm very proud of what we did, and I'm really happy that people are still interested in it.
Well, you guys are like, you know, near the top of my heroes.
Oh, thanks.
You and Michael Callan and so forth. And
mm-hmm. Well, we really had a great career, and it was, you know, it was just due to the great support of our fans. I mean, we really couldn't have done it without them. You know, we did everything ourselves. We never had financial support from a big record company or anything, but we pulled it off. It was really, really exciting. I really felt like we accomplished what we set out to. I mean, you know, our whole career. I mean, I don't know. I wanted to make a difference.
The one great line I read in one of your album notes that really does it for me is that you guys wrote the soundtracks to our lives.
Oh. Who said that? Somebody just said that about us. Do you know who
it was in the Brave Boys liner notes.
Oh, Kenny wrote that. Yeah, in the liner notes.
And that's so perfect.
Oh, that's nice. That is nice. Well, it was a privilege.
Yes, for me definitely.
Good. Yeah.